like Glenn Gould, and that's Glenn Gould playing Haydn, Piano Sonata No. 60. And that's our classical performances today. I'm Richard Nisley. The World up next right here at 89.7 FM, WGBH, Boston.
From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, Boston. It's Thursday, February 11th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. Today, life after the revolution. Iranians celebrate two decades of Islamic rule. And life before the revolution. The Shah's widow remembers her years in exile. Also, the threat from cyberspace. Computer-savvy terrorists who could conceivably punch in the destruction of an air traffic control system.
If they do that electronically, it's no different than if they planted a bomb. What people have to begin to understand is that we're talking about protecting Americans' lives and their livelihood here.
First, this news.
For the World, this is Alan Dow in the BBC newsroom in London. Thousands of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo have attended the funeral of 40 of their compatriots killed by Serbian police last month. Speaking to the mourners, the head of the International Monitors in Kosovo, William Walker, condemned the killings.
Today we stand united against those who committed this crime against humanity. The deaths in Racak demand justice, and justice must be seen to be done.
Meanwhile, NATO continues its preparations for intervention in Kosovo. Britain's Defense Secretary George Robertson says British tanks, artillery, and armored vehicles will be sent to the region next week. The Senate is continuing final deliberations in President Clinton's impeachment trial. All the signs are that he'll be acquitted when the final vote takes place. As Owen Fay reports from Washington, the actual vote count will say more about the Senate than the president.
The question is no longer if President Clinton will survive the impeachment trial, but by how many votes. The Democrats are hoping both articles of impeachment will win fewer than 50 votes, which is seen as the absolute minimum needed to validate the decision by the House Republicans to bring the trial in the first place. A report suggesting the president has vowed revenge on the Republican prosecutors has been angrily denied by White House spokesman Joe Lockhart. He says President Clinton is more concerned with getting on with the business of the country than in conducting any personal vendetta once the trial is over. For The World, I'm Owen Fay in Washington.
Huge crowds have paraded through the streets of the Iranian capital, Tehran, today, celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. President Mohammad Khatami says faith in the revolution is still strong, despite the economic crisis caused by falling oil prices. From Tehran, Jim Muir has more.
In his speech, President Khatami enumerated the achievements that have been scored over the past 20 years. He said that Iran continued to face many problems, but would overcome them if its people could maintain their unity. The conflicting trends which currently divide Iranian politics were, however, all too evident in the crowd itself. The most vociferous elements were supporters of the hardline Hezbollah, or Party of God. When Mr. Khatami arrived, they burned a big American flag, a practice of which he is known to disapprove. Factional politics have been largely set aside during the revolutionary celebrations. But now that they're over, the struggle over which direction the revolution should now take is expected to resume in earnest.
Jim Muir reporting. Women members of parliament in Italy wore jeans to work today. It was part of a protest against a ruling by the country's highest appeal court. The court ruled a woman wearing jeans could not have been raped because she must have allowed her alleged attacker to remove them. The Minister for Equal Opportunity says the judge had shown himself incapable of understanding the complexity of the case. The verdict has caused a storm of controversy in newspapers, TV talk shows, and on the Internet. At 4 minutes past the hour, this is Alan Dow in the BBC newsroom. You're listening to The World. Iraq says two civilians were killed during a U.S. air raid in the north of the country. Washington says American planes patrolling the air exclusion zone fired missiles after being threatened by Iraqi air defenses. Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz vows to continue challenging the no-fly zones.
It's a flagrant violation of international law. It's a flagrant disrespect to the Security Council resolutions, and we will continue our struggle against it, no matter what are the sacrifices and the consequences.
Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz. In Kenya, 81 members of a religious sect are standing trial. They're charged with possessing dangerous weapons. The sect, which is called Mungiki, was set up in 1987. Its followers are mainly young people who take part in ceremonies of allegiance. The Anglo-Dutch oil group Royal Dutch Shell have suffered a dramatic drop in profits. The company blames the slump on the falling price of oil. Last year, Royal Dutch Shell made $900 million. That's compared to $8 billion in 1997. The BBC's Andrew Walker reports.
The company does not blame oil prices for all its problems. It accepts that it has fallen behind its competitors, and analysts say that the returns it makes on its capital aren't as good as many other oil companies. The group is in the throes of a major reorganization intended to improve its financial performance. The group hopes to make annual savings of $2.5 billion. But the latest results reflect only the one-off costs of part of the program, more than $4 billion, including restructuring and redundancies.
Andrew Walker reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 162 points at 93.39. That's up nearly 2% today. The Nasdaq was up 84 points at 23.94, up more than 3.5 points. From the BBC Newsroom in London, this is Alan Dow. You're listening to The World.
The World is made possible in part by Merck, pharmaceutical research dedicated to preventing disease and improving health. Merck, committed to bringing out the best in medicine.
This is The World. I'm Lisa Mullins. Iranians were celebrating in the streets of Tehran today. It was the 20th anniversary of the country's Islamic Revolution. President Mohammad Khatami spoke to the crowd, promising to usher in a new era of law and order. On this day in 1979, the rule of Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi collapsed. By that time, he and his wife had fled the country. While the Shah died 5 months later, Farah Pahlavi has continued to live the good life. We'll hear Ms. Pahlavi's reflections about the events of 20 years ago in a moment. But first, we check in with the BBC's Jim Muir, who was in Tehran for today's celebrations.
We had this big festival rally down in Azadi Square, Freedom Square, which is one of the big meeting spots of Tehran, where a number of major routes converge. All along those routes, thousands, tens of thousands of Iranians marched and converged on the square, where they held a very big rally. And while they were waiting for President Khatami to arrive, there was things going on. There was helicopters circling in the sky overhead. They dropped thousands of multicolored leaflets down with revolutionary slogans on them, and then they dropped about 20 parachutists who came down with very bright orange canopies against the blue sky, very, very colorful, and that went down very well with the crowd.
Do you think the feeling was more of say, a 4th of July celebration, a 4th of July parade, or did it have more political overtones, such as some kind of a campaign rally or political rally?
These things are a bit of a reaffirmation. It's not just a vague independence thing. This is a very real remembrance of a revolution which is just one generation old, 20 years old. At the same time, of course, for many of the people there who are young people, and of course the bulk of Iran's population is now under 20, this was basically history for them, the revolution's history, the Shah's history, and it was for them a day off school, a day of holiday, a day to run around in the sunshine. So it was a mixture of a lot of things. It was a public holiday, but at the same time, for the people who were involved at the time, it was a very real remembrance of the very dramatic events which brought the revolution to power just exactly 20 years ago.
Some demonstrators, from what we understand, set fire to two American flags, which may not be that unusual, but they also had actors who were dressed as Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny, and I wonder if you can explain what's happening there, and did people there see it in kind of an ironic sense?
Well, I certainly saw American flags being burned. I didn't see Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse there. That may have been on another occasion, or maybe I was just in a different part of the crowd. Certainly, the way I saw it was that there were quite hardline people there, and that this was a deliberate message to President Khatami, because he has publicly stated last year that he is not in favor of burning the American flag. He even apologized for it. He is also not in favor of any slogans which begin "death to," be it America or anyone else. He says we should be talking about life, not death. So this was, I believe, a very calculated message to President Khatami from a fair section of the crowd.
And also very much illustrating what's happening there in terms of modern-day Iran, with a large majority of people who clearly want more freedom and voted this moderate president into office, and then the hardliners, the ones that you say you were nearby, including the clergy, the more Islamically inclined, who don't want Iran to open up even more. Can you tell us what is happening in terms of that struggle?
It's a very difficult struggle to quantify and to measure, because you're trying to measure two different things: the enormous popular and prestige support that President Khatami has, the huge groundswell of public opinion that lifted him to office. It didn't lift him to power, because the hardliners still have their hands on many of the levers of daily power. And what we're seeing at the moment is a very curious and a very slow struggle between those two different kinds of forces. President Khatami and the reformists are making headway, there's no doubt about that. Just a couple of days ago, we had the resignation of the intelligence minister following a scandal in which people in his ministry were involved and proven to be involved. So the fact that they were arrested and this was made public is a huge gain for him. But it is a slow process. Nobody really wants it to go fast, because there's a fear that if it did, it would mean dislocation and yet more upheaval.
Finally, Jim, you're as a veteran of the region, I wonder if you can tell us, if you can compare Iran today with the Iran of the day that the Shah's rule collapsed in 1979. What has changed and what's remained the same?
What has changed is that Iranians now have a sense of national independence and dignity, which they did not have at that time. They also have a measure of freedom of speech, especially in the press, which they certainly didn't have at that time. But there are, as you say, many changes that people are looking for in the realms of greater freedoms, more transparency, greater rule of law. All these are the things that President Khatami stands for, and that's why he won such huge support a couple of years ago when he was elected.
The BBC's Jim Muir speaking to us from Tehran. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Iranians heard today from some who led their Islamic revolution of 20 years ago. One person they did not hear from was at the center of events in 1979, but hasn't returned to Iran since. The Shah's wife now divides her time among New York, Cairo, and Paris, where she spoke with the world's Emily Kasriel for this report.
Iran's revolution didn't happen out of the blue. Discontent amongst Iranians had been brewing for years. It was directed at the Shah's corrupt regime, its uneven distribution of oil wealth, as well as its close ties with the USA. By 1978, demonstrations were getting out of control. BBC reporter Simon Dring described the scene.
It was quite simply the biggest demonstration ever staged in Iran. The march had been scheduled to start at 9, but the crowds were so enormous that it soon became obvious that any attempt at organization was impossible. And soon the city was ringing to the chants of God is great. But as the crowds pushed and swayed, dominant above all these cries were the insistent demands for independence, for an Islamic government, and for an end to the peacock throne.
The Shah and his wife, Empress Farah Pahlavi, were forced into exile. But first they had to find a country that would accept them. They tried Egypt, then Morocco, the Bahamas, and then Mexico. Today, in her elegant Paris apartment, surrounded by paintings, tapestries and photographs of her husband, Farah Pahlavi remembers her early years in exile.
Every day was a torture just to be there, to live, because then I would drag myself out of bed. I didn't even want to come out, but I had no other choice. And tried by maybe calling some friends, or especially doing exercise, forcing myself to go and swim or do something to not let myself go down, and not take tranquilizer or pills, because they feel me even worse.
Farah Pahlavi says what was especially shocking was the attitude of the United States, a country that had cultivated very close relations with oil-rich Iran, strategically located on the border with the Soviet Union. Only a year before the revolution, President Carter had spent New Year's Eve with the Shah and his family. And in December 1978, despite growing discontent in Iran, President Carter still pledged America's support for the Shah.
I think the predictions of doom and disaster that came from some sources have certainly not been realized at all. The Shah has our support, and he also has our confidence.
Yet only 2 months later, the tables had turned. Ayatollah Khomeini had returned to Iran, and the Shah's regime had been overthrown. President Carter changed his tune.
Our goals are now as they have been for the past few months, to prevent interference or intervention in the internal affairs of Iran by any outside power, and to honor the will of the Iranian people.
Today, the former empress still feels bitter towards the Carter administration.
Very, very much betrayed, and at the same time, the way they had been behaving with us, it was just so inhuman. Frankly, my husband and I didn't want so much to go to America because we knew the feeling of the media and the situation.
But the Shah's cancer diagnosis persuaded them to go to the U.S. for medical treatment. And they arrived in New York on October 23rd, 1979. 12 days later, Iranian students marched into the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took 53 Americans hostage.
It's going to be a very, very long siege indeed, by all indications. The students inside are determined to hang on. And outside, hundreds of people, some workers, some students, marching up and down, chanting their slogan.
Farah Pahlavi says she was shocked at how the Carter administration reacted to the hostage crisis.
It was stepping on all international laws. And instead of having a strong reaction, the reaction of the world, especially the American administration, to what has happened in Iran, they gave in. How can a country give in to blackmail?
But as the world focused on the plight of the American hostages, more information was coming to light about the activities of the Shah's own secret police force, SAVAK. Victims went to testify before the United Nations. The BBC's Alex Brody was there.
It was a grotesque sight. More than 100 people, some of them hideously deformed, came to tell their stories to the commission. I spoke through an interpreter to about 15 of them. Most said they were shot in demonstrations. 3 or 4 said they were tortured by SAVAK. One showed me the scars, which he said resulted from the application of electrodes to his body and needles to his head. Another had no eyes. He said they were put out with a gun.
Frankly, they have exaggerated so much the role of the secret police, and on purpose, and I think mostly the communists and some of the media outside.
While a former empress is keen to defend the reputation of her husband's regime, she's been credited as the only one who was able to tell him the truth about the growing discontent with his rule. 20 years on, the former empress takes a philosophical view of her own part in history.
You know that I have had a life, a role to play in a period of my life, and I hope that I played it well. Now I have another life, another role to play, and try to play that role as well as I can, and not to feel nostalgic about the past. I'm nostalgic about my country. I'm not nostalgic about being in a palace and wearing a tiara, not at all.
Farah Pahlavi has no immediate plans to return to Iran, with or without her tiara. And even if the Iranian regime does change, the chances of a return to the peacock throne are remote. For the world, this is Emily Kasriel.
Time now for a note from the world's back pages. See if you can hear anything unusual about this piano. This is a piano for lefties. The low notes are on the right side of the keyboard. The high notes are on the left. Even the foot pedals are reversed. The instrument was designed and built for the left-handed pianist Christopher Seed. Seed gives his first public performance on the piano tonight, and he says he loved it the moment he started playing it.
Not only did I discover that it was much easier to play from a physical point of view, but it was also giving me a lot more self-confidence and freedom of expression. So all in all, it seemed like a transformation.
The hope is the piano will inspire other lefties to play, but it could give the right-handed players some problems. Yes, if you want to hit just the right note with us, call our listener line at 617-868-5750 or email us at theworld@pri.org. Coming up, how a pair of jeans plays a role in a case of accused rape on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is sponsored by the Capital Group Companies, investing throughout the world for individuals and institutions. And The World is sponsored by Merck, dedicated to the needs of society through pharmaceutical research and consumer education to improve the quality of life. Merck, committed to bringing out the best in medicine.
And you're listening to The World on 89.7 FM WGBH. I'm Jennifer Jordan. Taking a look at the roads for you this Thursday afternoon. The lower deck is back to the Tobin merge. A central artery is jammed. Sumner is back to the tolls because of a left lane work crew at the exit. The Ted Williams Tunnel, though, is open to everyone until 5 a.m. Tuesday because of the holiday. Storrow is back to the Longfellow. The expressway southbound is heavy to Savin Hill. Northbound, you're back to Southampton Street. 93 is a good ride heading north. 128 north only has some pocketing through Lexington. Southbound, you've got some solar glare slowing you down at Great Plain Avenue and again approaching 95. The Pike westbound moves well from the Alston-Brighton tolls out through Weston. This WGBH traffic update is made possible by the Boston Celtics. 931-2222. Partly cloudy tonight, lows in the 30s to around 40 degrees. Another sunny, mild, and breezy day tomorrow with afternoon clouds moving in and with them the chance of rain. Highs near 60, though, so they're well worth it. 41 degrees at 421.
This is The World. I'm Lisa Mullins. Women lawmakers in Italy turned up for work in jeans today to protest a decision by the country's highest court to overturn a rape conviction. The court concluded that since the woman in the case was wearing jeans, she must not have resisted because, the court ruled, jeans are impossible to remove by force. The decision is good news to the man convicted of the rape. He was a driving instructor who had been sentenced to 3 years in jail for having raped one of his students. Carol Tarantelli is a former Italian member of parliament. She was involved in drafting Italy's rape laws, and she now works for the group Women Against Violence Against Women. Carol Tarantelli, can you tell us first off your own reaction to this ruling?
It's absolutely astounding. It's astounding what these judges have done. They've gone back to what used to be a macabre joke that went around in Italy, that the only real rape victim was dead because she proved that she really resisted being raped by struggling until she was murdered. But if she didn't get murdered, it meant she really basically wanted it.
I believe that women parliamentarians there, about 70 in all, are planning to raise this issue strongly before the House today. And since this is not a blanket ruling for all rape cases where the alleged victim is wearing jeans, this is more of an isolated case, it seems. Why do you think this has caused such a shockwave through the system?
Well, because it's shocking. In itself, it's shocking. It's a return to a mentality that we hoped the courts had abandoned forever, which used to be quite common, actually, in Italy, as I suppose also in the rest of the world. And the other thing is that that when the Supreme Court overturns a decision, it goes back to the court that tried it, the appeals court in this case. So it will have to be retried, and we hope that the public outcry will instruct the judges that perhaps they'd better think better and more seriously about the whole case.
You talk about the public outcry, but I wonder if that's maybe a particular group in the judiciary or perhaps in the political circles there, because if this seems to be the view of the Supreme Court, there must be some sort of entrenched feeling among the populace there as well, perhaps a more, you might call it a more regressive attitude on sexual matters than in political circles.
Italy is definitely behind the United States in the sort of widespread consciousness of how serious a crime rape is. There has been a great deal of change in the 20 years that we fought to reform the rape bill, but I think it has gone through in many sectors and also in many sectors of the judiciary system. It's just these three judges, one section of the Supreme Court, which has many sections, which apparently have not gotten the message and have not thought about it and are just relying on old knee-jerk reactions of collusion, intimate collusion with rapists.
Have they responded, those three judges, to some of the response from, for instance, women parliamentarians?
Well, they have said that they took into account many, many complex issues to reach their decision, and it wasn't just the genes. The woman wasn't abrased, and there were no contusions because she claimed that she had been so terrified by the rapist that she didn't resist him, which is very common in rape cases.
Carol Tarantelli is a former Italian member of parliament speaking to us from Rome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From our business page today, Nissan Motor is getting all prettied up for what it hopes is a big date with Daimler Chrysler. Nissan's truck-making affiliate said today it will close an assembly plant and cut 3,000 jobs. The restructuring effort is likely to help Nissan in its ongoing merger talks with Daimler Chrysler. And Nissan isn't the only Japanese carmaker investigating alliances with foreign partners. From Tokyo, the world's Lucy Craft reports on the merger fever that is spreading through Japan's auto industry.
On paper, there are 8 car makers and 3 truck companies in Japan, but that's a bit misleading. Most of the companies are linked in some way to a major auto producer, such as Ford's management of Mazda or GM's equity stake in Isuzu. But analysts predict that a host of new alliances are in store, in part because of stagnant demand here in Japan. So far, there's been no outright buyout of a Japanese carmaker by a foreign firm, and analysts such as Steve Usher of Jardine Fleming Securities are ruling it out.
While I don't expect to see a huge rash of mega mergers, we would expect to see quite a few capital participations. We've seen that in the past. We would expect that that trend would continue and, in fact, accelerate.
Nonsense, say experts like Noriyuki Matsushima, a car analyst for Nikko Salomon Smith Barney Securities. Matsushima says that the competition is now so fierce and the economics of producing a new car so staggering, only a few players can and will survive.
For all automakers, the keys to survival are strength on 3 fronts: anti-pollution technology, safety devices, and computerization. But the R&D costs for staying ahead in all 3 areas are so immense, no one company can shoulder it all. That's why we're seeing this rush to join forces.
Matsushima reckons that the only car makers likely to last on the global stage are what he calls the 4 million club, the 5 automakers which produce at least 4 million units a year. The 4 million club, which includes GM, Ford, VW, and Daimler Chrysler, has just one Japanese member, Toyota.
Even if you come up with a technological breakthrough, it's useless unless you can produce it globally at low cost. So it pays to be a large-scale producer. We say that companies which produce more than 4 million cars a year are the only ones that have a right to survive.
For non-Japanese automakers, tying up with a Japanese competitor has 2 virtues. Americans and Europeans don't have much of a presence in the Asian market, so the alliance may offer instant access to this region. Japanese companies are also considered to hold the lead in anti-pollution technology. In this blizzard of mergers, how's the consumer to keep all the names straight? Steve Usher says you won't have to.
The consumer, I don't think, is going to notice a whole lot. The fact of the matter is that the major changes are going to be much more subtle. The ability to fund R&D, changes in technology, changes in shared platforms. So while the exterior of the vehicle may not change much at all, the interior could become much more commonized across the lineup.
Only a decade ago, Japanese automakers were the gold standard of manufacturing. But now that Japanese-style assembly lines are commonplace almost everywhere, sheer size has become a critical factor for survival. For the world, this is Lucy Craft in Tokyo.
For today's geography quiz, we're looking for a volcano that's been acting up lately. The nearly 18,000-foot volcano erupted 3 months ago, spewing lava, flaming boulders, and ash for days. Last week, it rumbled and belched gas and ash that was visible 30 miles away in Mexico City. Our mystery volcano's Aztec name means smoking mountain. More than 30 million people live within view, and hundreds of thousands of people would be endangered by a major eruption. Once again, we're looking for a volcano in central Mexico that's been rumbling a lot of late. We'll get too close for comfort when we answer today's geography stumper in the next half hour of our show. Don't blow your top if you miss the world on the radio. You can hear us in cyberspace 24 hours a day at www.theworld.org. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
And this is WGBH. I'm Jennifer Jordan. The Central Artery southbound is slow from Dock Square. Northbound is tough end-to-end. Sumner's back to the tolls. Ted Williams is open, though, for all traffic until Tuesday morning. Storo is back to the Longfellow. The expressway is jammed to South Bay with pockets to Savin. Northbound stalls out after the Southampton Street area. Route 3 north is slow around Concord Road and from 495 to 110. 128 south has slowdowns from Great Plain Ave to 135, and the Pike is moving well. It's 4:30.
I'm Lisa Mullen. Still ahead on the world, the threat from cyberspace. Our series on modern-day terrorism examines a new kind of terror. And last year was weird. How weird?
1998 was 4.1% weirder.
Also, the Mexican sextet of El Tri, honoring the spirit of 68. First, this news.
For the world, this is Alan Dow in the BBC newsroom in London. Thousands of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo have attended the funeral of 40 of their compatriots killed by Serbian police last month. The head of the International Monitors, William Walker, attended the funerals and condemned the killings as a crime against humanity. The BBC's correspondent Jackie Rowland was also there.
It was a somber and dignified end to what has been a month of anguish for the families of the Ratchak victims. Thousands of people walked for miles across snowbound fields to witness the final laying to rest of the 40 villagers. A slow procession of coffins draped in the red and black flag of Albania snaked up the icy slope. At the top, an imam said a prayer for the dead, and the head of the Kosovo monitoring mission, William Walker, gave his own personal address to the families of the victims.
Jackie Rowland reporting. Indonesian President B.J. Habibie says he favors independence for the troubled territory of East Timor. He wants to see a solution within a year. This is a major policy U-turn after nearly a quarter of a century of Indonesian occupation. East Timorese independence leader and winner of a Nobel Peace Prize, José Ramos Horta, says Indonesia's change of heart is due to the long years of resistance.
The case of East Timor proves that no amount of weapons or violence or brute force used by regimes against their people, against a small nation, will ever be enough to resolve the problem.
East Timor's independence leader José Ramos Horta. The Taliban in Afghanistan is warning the United States not to carry out further attacks against Afghan-based Saudi millionaire Osama bin Laden. Washington accuses bin Laden of being the person behind the U.S. embassy bombings in East Africa. Yesterday, the Taliban imposed restrictions on the Saudi dissident, saying they'd cut his communications link with the outside world. But State Department spokesman James Foley says that's not good enough.
Let's remember, this is someone who has killed innocent civilians, number one, and number two, who has promised to continue killing innocent civilians. And therefore, he must be brought to justice, and we continue to call on the Taliban to expel him from Afghanistan in such a way that he can be brought to justice.
James Foley. A new chief executive has been appointed to head Salt Lake City's preparations for the 2002 Winter Olympics. He's Mitt Romney, a millionaire and prominent member of the Mormon Church, which is based in Salt Lake City. An internal inquiry found two top officials leading the city's bid for the Games paid over $1 million to members of the IOC. Meanwhile, other investigations continue, including one by the FBI. Austria is returning 250 works of art to the Rothschilds banking family. They were looted by the Nazis and absorbed into state museums after World War II. Last year, the Austrian government set up a commission of experts to trace the rightful owners of looted art. The Minister of Cultural Affairs says the restitution signals a new awareness by Austria. This is The World.
The World is brought to you by the Capital Group Companies, investing throughout the world for individuals and institutions.
This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. I'm Lisa Mulland. Many experts in modern-day warfare believe the tools of terrorism in the 21st century are likely to be things like anthrax, plague, sarin, and VX gas. But there are other seemingly less poisonous new weapons that would-be terrorists have already started using. Their names are worms, logic bombs, and Trojan horses. Their aim is to destroy government information systems and emergency services. And the battlefield is most often the Internet. In part four of our week-long series on modern-day terrorism, the world's Patrick Cox examines the deadly threat of cyber terrorism.
2 weeks ago, the residents of New York City got a small taste of what an attack by cyber terrorists might be like. The city's new state-of-the-art 911 system broke down, this time not through a cyber attack, but because of human error and mechanical problems. For an hour, though, people calling emergency services got busy signals, and at least one death was blamed on the failure. Now, just suppose that a lone cyber terrorist were to hack into the 911 system and shut it down for hours. The impact on emergency health services, fire rescue, and police response could be incalculable. President Clinton is concerned enough about the possibility of this kind of event happening that he's proposing spending $1.5 billion on protecting the country's vital systems from electronic assaults. Last month, Mr. Clinton made his case.
We already are seeing the first wave of deliberate cyber attacks. Hackers break into government and business computers, stealing and destroying information, raiding bank accounts, running up credit card charges, extorting money by threats to unleash computer viruses. The potential for harm is clear. We have to be ready for adversaries to launch attacks that could paralyze utilities and services across entire regions.
Cyber attacks have already disrupted U.S. troop deployments to the Persian Gulf. They've temporarily downed more than 100 U.S. defense systems, and they've accounted for thefts amounting to more than $10 billion. Almost every single Fortune 500 company has been broken into electronically. Security specialists are bracing for major online sabotage of stock exchanges and hospitals, or something even worse, an electronic Pearl Harbor. Under that scenario, terrorists would stage a cyber attack that downs utilities and 911 systems and simultaneously set off a bomb or even a chemical agent. Jeffrey Hunker heads a new federal agency, the Critical Infrastructure Assurance Office, that's charged with coordinating public and private defenses against cyber terrorism.
There are people out there. There are terrorist groups. There's organized crime, cartels. There's nation states that are looking at and developing the capabilities to attack these information systems that we depend on.
The so-called Y2K millennium bug has alerted many businesses and the public to our dependence on interconnected computer systems that control everything from gas pressure to ATMs. But what many people have not yet grasped is that a computer mouse can be as destructive as a Kalashnikov rifle. Jeffrey Hunker says computer hackers who interfere with air traffic control systems, for example, may end up with blood on their hands.
If they do that electronically, it's no different than if they planted a bomb. There's still a view that says that sort of hacker activity is somehow innocent, that it should be viewed as just playing around. What people have to begin to understand is that we're talking about protecting Americans' lives and their livelihood here.
But here's where things can get a little tricky. Sometimes hacker activity, while not completely innocent, may be constitutionally protected. As more people use computers, more of them are choosing to exercise their First Amendment right to protest their government online.
What the software does is allow people to reload a targeted website several times per minute.
Carmen Karasik operates a web art and design business from her home in Quincy, Massachusetts. She's also a member of an online hacktivist collective called the Electronic Disturbance Theater, which stages cyber protests. When someone somewhere logs onto the collective's website, they're automatically linked to a second website, one that Karasik's group is targeting. Here's how it works.
We send out an email, a call for participation to thousands and thousands of people around the world, and we ask them to, on a particular day, to go to our website, which is FloodNet, and just leave their browser open there for however much time they can. And when they do that, that will cause the targeted website to be requested by their browser several times per minute.
As the targeted website server is flooded with requests, the site can freeze, temporarily denying access for anyone trying to log on. Although she's been called a cyber terrorist, Karasik doesn't believe that what she does is any less legal than standing on a picket line. She says her software doesn't do any damage and only slows down access to the website her group is protesting. But there is, Rasa concedes, plenty of hacker software readily available on the web that can be highly destructive.
There's software that you can get that will crash a server. There's software that you can get that will overwhelm a server with email, anonymous email at that. There's software you can get that will use forms to get into the server and then change data or destroy data in servers.
While most people log on to the Pentagon's website to get information about the U.S. military or check out its multimedia center, many hacktivists have tried to shut it down or slow it down. Others have launched full-scale cyber attacks. Most are successfully defended within minutes, but at least one, the words of one government official, consumed an incredible amount of resources for several weeks. There's no technology for pinpointing the source of a cyber attack, and even if there were, U.S. authorities could do little to apprehend or punish someone hitting them electronically from halfway across the world. Right now, neither U.S. nor international law sets out the conditions permissible for a cyber attack or a counterattack, nor is there any legal understanding of the difference between a cyber terrorist and a hacktivist. Jonathan Zittrain, who directs the Berkman Center for the Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, worries that when these laws are eventually written, they'll be reactionary.
Somehow technology, perhaps because it's so opaque, scares people. And you don't want that hysteria to drive you. I mean, there are threats, there are ways to counteract them, and you want to kind of balance them properly. But if you just think of, oh no, they could bring down the power grid, if you start from that premise, it almost gives you license to imagine any form of intervention as appropriate.
The U.S. government has largely stayed on the legal sidelines as the Internet has developed. But as the threat of cyber terrorism increases, the government may be tempted to regulate the Internet more closely. So, for example, it can eavesdrop on email correspondences. After all, many groups the State Department identifies as terrorists are already online. Both Hamas and Hezbollah maintain their own web pages. And Osama bin Laden, accused of the lethal bombings of two U.S. embassies last year, uses laptops to send encrypted messages to members of his global network. In this country, too, racist and fringe anti-abortion groups, which may spawn or attract terrorists, have established themselves on the web. Harvard's Jonathan Zittrain, though, cautions against increased government oversight of the Internet. He says terrorists' very reliance on cyberspace could be their greatest vulnerability.
It's harder for them to keep secrets. It's easier for them to be infiltrated by somebody from very far away whose identity is not readily verified. And as a result, combating terrorism may actually be easier than combating it when it is highly localized, highly physically bound together.
In fact, White House plans to counter online terrorism include establishing a core of young people who know their way around cyberspace. Sources say the FBI in particular needs computer literate workers. President Clinton also wants to beef up research into how to detect attempts to sneak into off-limits data banks and how vital online networks can stave off intrusion. Until then, Carmen Karasik of the Electronic Disturbance Theater will continue to make all kinds of trouble online and to make the software she does it with available to other hacktivists.
Ah, there it is. Oh, look at this! They downloaded my work!
For the world, this is Patrick Cox.
Okay, so see, they put their own image in there. Remember, we have the Zapatista image. And we are, in fact, flooding. We are going to whatever website they've pointed this thing at. So we are participating in this act of electronic civil disobedience.
Tomorrow, security experts consider how to respond to what many say is inevitable, a terrorist strike that kills thousands.
We don't want to have a new McCarthyism after an event of catastrophic terrorism. And the way to avoid that is to deal with it before an event occurs.
That's the final part of our series on modern-day terrorism, tomorrow on The World. Time now for the answer to our geography quiz today. We're looking for the name of the most active and most famous volcano in Mexico. This smoking mountain has gained a reputation for magnificent eruptions. They were first recorded by the Aztec Indians in the year 1347. Mike Sheridan is the chairman of the geology department at the State University of New York and a volcanologist. Mr. Sheridan, first off, what is the answer to our geo quiz?
Popocatépetl.
Could you repeat that, please?
Popocatépetl.
Popocatépetl, which is spelled P-O-P-O-C-A-T-E-P-E-T-L. It's, I presume, an Aztec word. Why is this volcano deserving of such fame?
Well, this is such a huge volcano. It is the fourth highest mountain in North America, and it has this reputation because it's surrounded by a dense population, making it a very dangerous volcano indeed.
And we are seeing more rumblings apparently lately at the volcano. I know that you've been able to get up close and personal. How close have you come, and tell us what it looks like?
The volcano itself is extremely high, and the summit area is prohibited now for general observation, but I've been over the volcano in a helicopter, and I've been up near the ice mass. More recently, being a couple of weeks ago, standing on top of another volcano, Citlaltépetl, which is a little bit taller, and about 200 miles away, I saw plumes of smoke coming out of Popo as it went through another shaking and spitting out of ash.
And is this an unusual amount of activity that's happening now?
Let's say that Popo is a volcano that has infrequent but violent eruptions. So that since the time of the conquest, there have been some small episodes of ash eruption, but its present activity is the most pronounced it's had in a long time.
So when was the last time that it actually kind of blew full force?
The last really big eruption of Popo was nearly 1,000 years ago. So we haven't had a big event like that, but it was certainly catastrophic when it did go. And it's gone through these phases of climactic instability where a whole sector of the volcano will slide away, as happened at Mount St. Helens. But since this volcano is so much larger than Mount St. Helens, that the effect would be disastrous nowadays if such an event were to occur.
Why would it be disastrous? You said that there is a large population around it. Are we talking sort of like a Pompeii kind of surrounding where there is an active town just at the foot of the volcano?
The numbers of people affected by even a mid-size eruption here could be a couple million people.
Are people moving away because of the threat?
Well, when volcanoes don't erupt for generations, people are very wary of warnings about such eruptions. And in this case, people have been living near this volcano for such a long time. This volcano is actually a source of water supply for the highest cultures developed in the Americas.
Because of that ice layer, the snow cap.
Because of the snow cap, it provides water in an environment that is essentially a semi-desert environment otherwise.
Would you say that the neighbor is there, as much as they consider it a benevolent volcano at this point, would you say that they would be wise to move away? How great do you believe the danger is of an eruption anytime soon?
Well, first of all, 2 million people can't move away. Where would they move to, and how would they move? And it's probably not expedient for them to move at this point. So moving might not be the answer. The problem is particularly perplexing. We watch this volcano now as it's been erupting since December of 1994, going through periods of seismic activity, lava's coming out, it's filling the crater, ash is being produced, and there even have been good evacuation plans. But to implement plans at such a scale, this has never been done before, so the problem is really immense.
I guess understanding all that, I wonder if you were a resident there, if you would live there, or if you had the opportunity to pack up and leave, if you'd do so.
It's one of those things where conditions could change quite rapidly. I don't think I would leave at the moment, but I think I would be ready to leave. I think I would back my car into the garage rather than drive it in.
Mike Sheridan is a volcanologist and the chair of the geology department at the State University of New York. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Keeping track of the weirder things in life for a living, next on PRI, Public Radio International.
The world is made possible in part by Merck, a research-driven pharmaceutical company discovering, developing, and manufacturing a broad range of human and animal health products and services. Merck, committed to bringing out the best in medicine. And the world is brought to you by the Capital Group, investing throughout the world for individuals and institutions.
And you're listening to The World on 89.7 FM WGBH in Boston. I'm Jennifer Jordan. Taking a look at the roads for you once again. The lower deck of 93 and the southbound artery are a good ride. The Sumner is a bit heavy inside, but not to worry because the Ted Williams Tunnel is open to everyone. That means you until 5 a.m. on Tuesday. The expressway southbound is heavy to South Bay and some pockets onto Savin. Northbound, you're jammed from the lane split coming in. 93 has some volume, but no major hangups all the way up to Wilmington. 128 north is slow through Lexington. Southbound, you're slow from Route 3 into Lexington because of some solar slowdowns. Route 3 north is slow from Concord Road to Treble Cove and from 495 to 110. The Mass Pike has some minor slowdowns through West Newton out to the police barracks. This WGBH traffic update is made possible by Cellular One, the wireless experts, 1-800-SELL-1. 39 degrees in Boston, partly cloudy, lows for 30 tonight, a nice day tomorrow, sunny and mild and breezy. It's 4:50. This is the World. I'm Lisa Mullins. The title of an old gospel song tells us there are strange things happening every day. There are, and we reported on them. For instance, remember that soccer match in South Africa last October?
A bolt of lightning struck the pitch and sent half the players on it tumbling to the ground, deafened, blinded, and shot.
Then last month, 14 members of a U.S. cult in Israel were accused of planning violent acts to hasten the return of Jesus.
All are through the themes of the Book of Revelations, with its mysterious prophecies of cataclysms and bloodshed to mark the end of time.
It's true, strange things are happening every day. And according to a London-based journal of unexplained phenomena, the world is getting even weirder as the millennium approaches. Joe McNally is a contributing editor of the Portland Times. For you guys, Joe, who work with the weird every day, how do you define exactly what weird is?
Well, no, that's the $64,000 question. How can I put this nicely? We know it when we see it. Whenever we get together to sort out all our clippings and to get them into various categories for publication in the magazine, if there's a story that gets the entire editorial team almost paralyzed with laughter, then we know it's real.
So, in terms of how you define weirdness, I guess you actually have some kind of an index to measure those things. How does that work?
It's not the most rigorously scientific of things, I have to admit. What we do, as I say, we sort out the clippings we're sent into 34 categories and just see whether there's been more or less stories in each category each year.
And how did it work in 1998? How weird was 1998?
1998 was 4.1% weirder than 1997.
So, can you tell me about the most weird events that you found during 1998? What would you categorize as even perhaps more strange than ones we just heard in the introduction?
Well, our favorite, I think, has to be the amazing story of God's Salvation Church. Who are a tiny cult who have been wandering around North America for the last couple of years. And in 1998, they settled in a town called Garland in Texas. And proclaimed that Jesus was going to return, I think it was around the end of March. But they gave a very definite date and time when Jesus would be returning. But what actually happened was when Jesus failed to turn up, the cult's leader, who's a Taiwanese pharmacist called Hon Ming Chen, he leaned out of the door and said, "You know, I'm afraid I've just been talking complete rubbish. Perhaps we'd all better go home." And the whole cult just sort of dissipated.
Are there other real strange ones that you're especially fond of?
We have another story from Colchester in the south of England. The police were stopping traffic looking for drunk drivers and checking up on vehicle details and what have you, and they found somebody who was wearing gumboots full of baked beans.
Why? Why people have this question?
He wouldn't say.
Now, what is the millennium effect in this?
It's terribly cynical of me, but I think the millennium effect in this is that most of our stories come from the world's press. And the millennium effect is that newspapers around the world now see that there's a market for weirdness. and they're much more willing to give column space to stories about Bigfoot or UFOs or whatever than they would have been, say, 5-6 years ago.
Now, I know you're not a millennialist, but have you found evidence that the year 998 was a pretty weird one, too?
Well, I've heard that the Dark Ages were caused because the calendars then weren't year 1000 compliant.
Well, I wonder if you care to make any forecasts for 1999. How's it shaping up so far?
Not too badly. We've had some very interesting UFO reports from Ireland. And we've also had an incredible story about a giant thing, basically, that somebody did in Australia. They used bulldozers and satellite relay systems to draw the outline of an Aborigine warrior in the middle of the Australian desert. And the drawing can't be seen from the ground because it's 2 miles high. And the entire outline, I think, is 16 miles.
Joe McNally, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Joe McNally is the contributing editor of the Fortean Times, which is the Journal of Unexplained Phenomena, out of London. For today's closing music, we check out the latest album by a band that's been cited both times the Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences has chosen the year's best Latin rock performances. Last year, El Tri didn't take home the Grammy. This year, who knows? The world's Marco Werman profiles the Mexican sextet.
Critics have called Mexico City's El Tri the Rolling Stones of Mexico.
But with songs like El Viaje, El Tri seems to come closer to Weird Al Yankovic, being a goofy commercial part for Pfizer. Still, Hornet Records Latina has to be great. El Tri is one of two bands in the label's portfolio that's gotten a nod for Best Latin Rock Grammy this year. El Tri's composer and bass player, Alex Lores, was rocking as a teenager in the 60s, founding the soul band Three Souls in My Mind. The Three Souls would later become El Tri, which refers to the tricolor, Mexico's green, white, and red flag.
Alex Lora's band was born in 1968, a turbulent year in Mexican history. It's when police killed dozens of university students during riots that preceded the 1968 Mexico City Olympics. El Tri has recorded 30 albums since then. El Tri's latest CD, the Grammy-nominated Fin de Siglo, or End of the Century, weaves rock blues through light satire and deadly serious subjects. In Amarga Navidad, or Bitter Christmas, Alex Lora and bandmates remember the 1997 killing of 45 Mayan Indians in Chiapas at the hands of paramilitary gunmen. As other bands born in the rebellious 60s sell their songs to computer companies and fast food chains, El Tri seems to be sticking to its anti-establishment values. For the world, this is Marco Werman.
El 22 de diciembre, dos días antes de la Navidad. Cuando en los altos de Chiapas la sangre se derramó, fue una masacre al estilo de la Santa Inquisición.
Music from Mexico's El Tri. On the subject of music, we've been getting some suggestions for the American artist who has stood most prominently on the world music stage. There have been votes for the jazz great Duke Ellington, for blues pioneer Robert Johnson, and for talking head David Byrne, among others. Keep them coming. You can email us at theworld@pri.org. In Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins.
The
World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Teresa and H. John Hines III Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
And the world is also made possible by Muro Pharmaceutical Incorporated and AstraMedica Company of Tewksbury, engaged in the research, development, manufacture, distribution, and sale of pharmaceutical products. I'm Jennifer Jordan. Good afternoon. Coming up next is All Things Considered, and then at 6:30, it's Marketplace for a full rundown of the business news. Taking a look at the roads for you in the meantime, the north side of the central artery is a tough ride end-to-end. South ride's all right. Ted Williams is open to everyone until Tuesday at 5 a.m. because of the holiday weekend. The expressway is heavy to Savin with some minor congestion approaching the split. Northbound, you're back to the Mass Ave lane split. 93 is a good ride. 128 is slow from 38 up to 93. And southbound, you have some solar slowdowns from Route 3 into Lexington. All Things Considered is coming up next. It is made possible by very generous listeners like you in partnership with Workbench, celebrating 43 years of classic modern furniture for every room in your home, with stores in Boston, Cambridge, Natick, and Lexington. 39 degrees at 5 o'clock.
NATO has a plan for enforcing a peace settlement in Kosovo with troops.
But so far, no peace plan. Negotiations continue at Rambouillet Castle near Paris.
It's Thursday, February 11th, and this is NPR's All Things Considered.
Victims killed by Serb police in the village of Rachak were buried today.
In the U.S., banking reforms to modernize a system put in place after the Great Depression.
A new test for heart disease. Some doctors are concerned that the test might encourage patients to believe they're better off than they are.
It means I'll go out and have a cheeseburger. I guess it'll mean that there is no obvious signs of cardiovascular disease. So I feel happy.
Also, reworking airbags.
Lawsuits against handgun makers.
And Sabine, a Texas restaurant that takes down-home cooking to new places.
Now the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Clinton. The Senate continued its closed-door deliberations today in the trial of President Clinton. The Senate is expected to vote tomorrow on the perjury and obstruction of justice charges. Supporters of a resolution censuring President Clinton after his expected acquittal have nearly given up hope of approving censure this week. But that hasn't stopped individual senators from condemning President Clinton's behavior. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Reckless, tawdry, shameful, despicable, immoral. Those descriptions of the president's conduct are offered by lawmakers who intend to acquit him. As prospects for a tough censure resolution fade, at least in the short term, supporters may simply sign an informal statement of condemnation. Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin, who thinks a formal censure would set a bad precedent, offered his own censure.
The president has brought dishonor to himself, brought tremendous pain and embarrassment to his family, his friends, and his colleagues, and I consider myself one of those. And rather than ennobling the presidency, this particular behavior has made it the butt of jokes and ridicule.
If nothing else, the searing comments on Mr. Clinton's personal behavior serve as a reminder that senators of both parties intend to hold the president to his promise not to declare victory, but to move directly to policy issues and work with Congress. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, the Capitol.
British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook said today that the Serbs are to blame for the lack of progress at the Kosovo peace talks near Paris. After visiting the talks for a second time, Cook said the Serbian delegation is wasting time by demanding that the two sides sign a basic set of principles before they begin negotiating. International mediators say the principles were agreed to by the mere fact that the sides came to the talks. The Serbs want guarantees that the outcome of the talks won't change Yugoslavia's current borders. Massachusetts venture capitalist Mitt Romney is the new CEO of the Salt Lake Olympic Organizing Committee. And Romney was named today as Olympic organizers try to put the Olympic corruption scandal behind them. From Salt Lake City, Howard Berkus reports.
The Salt Lake Olympic Organizing Committee tried to move forward today by hiring a new CEO, shaking up its board, and establishing new ethics and conflict of interest rules. The CEO job goes to Mitt Romney, a Massachusetts member of the Utah-based Mormon Church, known for his ability to rescue troubled corporations. Romney was the choice of Utah Governor Mike Leavitt and Olympic Board Chair Bob Garth. The Salt Lake Olympic Board approved the choice as it reorganized itself and accepted the resignations of three members. Two have received Olympic contracts worth millions of dollars. The third was prominently involved in the scandal-plagued Olympic bid. Governor Leavitt says another resignation is expected. Outgoing CEO Frank Joklik remains on the board, despite the fact that the scandal occurred under his watch. I'm Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
And this is NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from SAP, business software helping over 9,000 companies in 90 countries. SAP, a better return on information. I'm Jennifer Jordan in Boston. An elderly pilot was killed today when his small plane crashed about a half mile from the Leominster-Fitchburg Airport. The pilot wasn't immediately identified, but he was said to be 70 years old. Officials said the plane went down near commuter rail tracks on Beacon Street, and debris from the plane was scattered on the tracks, disrupting commuter service for a time. Governor Cellucci threw his support behind the plans to build a new runway at Logan Airport today, saying it would help create an efficient, hassle-free airport. The runway would be used for takeoffs and landings over the ocean and would handle about 75,000 flights a year. Winthrop residents have lobbied against a new runway, complaining it would add to their noise pollution problems. But Cellucci says Massport will set up noise mitigation plans for communities surrounding the airport. The governor also hopes to reduce delays at Logan by making better use of Worcester Airport. He's asking Massport to look at ways to increase jet service and cargo operations in Worcester. And yes, Mitt Romney has been named to head Salt Lake City's scandal-ridden Olympics Organizing Committee. Romney is a businessman from Belmont who unsuccessfully challenged Senator Edward Kennedy in 1994. He also has strong ties to Salt Lake as an elder in the Mormon Church. He takes over the committee amid deepening allegations that members bribed International Olympic Committee officials to land the 2002 Winter Games for Salt Lake. Romney says his goal is to make Utah proud and to make America proud. He's promising that the Games will comply with the highest level of ethical conduct. And there is sharp criticism today for the test given to prospective Massachusetts teachers. That test caused an uproar last April when 59% of the teaching candidates who took it for the first time flunked. But an ad hoc trio of education experts says it's not the test takers, but the test itself which should get failing grades. And they're recommending that the state stop the teacher tests while it reviews them. Taking a look at the roads for you, the northbound artery is a tough ride end-to-end. The expressway is heavy to Savin. Northbound, you're back to the lane split. 93 is okay heading north. 128 north is slow from 38 to 93. Route 3 north is slow from Concord Road to Treble Cove. 128 south of town has a breakdown at Highland Avenue, and it's heavy from East Street to 95.
This is NPR's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. In Brussels today, NATO ambassadors approved the broad outlines of a plan for a peacekeeping force in Kosovo. The deployment of ground forces to Kosovo depends on the warring parties reaching a political settlement for the Serbian province. Sarah Chase reports from Rambouillet Castle outside Paris, where peace negotiations are nearing the end of their first week.
Today, the conference co-chair, British Foreign Secretary Robin Cook, took the Serbian delegation to task. He said negotiators haven't been able to get down to the specifics of the draft settlement because the Serbs keep insisting that both parties sign a preliminary statement of principles. He praised the Albanian seriousness of purpose. But despite slow progress in the negotiations here, NATO officials are pushing ahead with plans to send a ground force to Kosovo to help implement the settlement. Under the draft settlement, for example, unarmed international monitors are to supervise a restructuring of the Kosovo police, a drastic cutback in Serbian security forces, and a gradual disarmament of paramilitary groups like the Kosovo Liberation Army. Diplomats say the NATO troops would back the monitors up in these tasks. All the details of the NATO mission are set out in a separate military annex to the Rambouillet Peace Accord. NATO ambassadors in Brussels are reportedly referring to this annex as they make their operational plans. But the military annex has not yet officially been submitted to the two warring parties. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Chase in Rambouillet.
Funerals have taken place in Kosovo for 40 ethnic Albanians killed by Serbian police a month ago. Thousands of people came to the village of Racak to join the mourners. The families were able to bury their dead relatives after Serbian authorities stopped insisting the bodies be released from the morgue a few at a time. Jackie Rowland was at the funeral and has this report.
On the snowy hillside overlooking Ratchak, villagers set to work digging 40 graves for the coffins lying in the village school below. It's a long, hard task, but at least the ground is no longer frozen. The people of Ratchak have waited almost 4 weeks for this day. Now they can finally lay their dead to rest and try to bury the nightmare of the massacre with them. There's scarcely a family in the village that wasn't in some way bereaved by the massacre. Ratchak is now little more than a ghost town. Its inhabitants only pay visits during daylight hours to feed their cattle. But today the crowds of mourners are swollen by thousands of people who've come in solidarity from neighbouring villages.
Allahu Akbar. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
The local imam says a prayer for the dead, the coffins laid out in rows in front of him. Then hundreds of men take the coffins on their shoulders and carry them to the hilltop. The long procession snakes up the hillside, the 40 coffins draped in the red and black flag of Albania. The people of Ratchak invited the head of the International Monitoring Mission in Kosovo, US diplomat William Walker, to speak at the funeral. Once again, he condemns the killings by the Serbian police.
Today we stand united against those who committed this crime against humanity. The deaths in Ratchak demand justice, and justice must be seen to be done.
After weeks of degrading argument between the Serbian authorities and ethnic Albanian political leaders, the dead of Ratchak have finally been given a dignified funeral. But the fear remains. A police helicopter buzzing over the graveyard and Serb snipers on the hill opposite are a reminder of the continuing threat to ethnic Albanian villagers all over Kosovo. For NPR News, this is Jackie Rowland in Ratchak.
New ballistic missiles in China and talk of a U.S. missile defense system have increased tensions in East Asia. This week, Taiwanese officials said China has increased the number of missiles aimed at Taiwan to more than 100. Other reports say China is expanding its entire arsenal of ballistic missiles, which are capable of carrying nuclear warheads. This gives new urgency to a debate about whether the United States should provide a missile defense system for its Asian allies and perhaps Taiwan, if and when such a system is devised. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
China's expanding arsenal of ballistic missiles serves at least two purposes. It warns the people of Taiwan not to move toward independence, as they sometimes seem inclined to do. China regards Taiwan as a renegade province and threatens to attack it if it formally breaks away from the motherland. In pointing more missiles toward Taiwan, China is following the advice of one of its greatest strategists, according to James Lilly of the American Enterprise Institute.
I think you've got to read Sun Tzu and say that the greatest battles are won without firing a shot and without killing anybody. You've always got to be willing to use your force, but basically you're trying to intimidate your opposition.
And China's growing missile arsenal is also a response to Washington's tentative plans to develop a missile defense system, sometimes referred to as theater missile defense. Robert Manning of the Council on Foreign Relations notes that China has a relatively small nuclear deterrent.
And if I was a Chinese military planner, I might worry that if any of these systems actually worked, it might neutralize my deterrent. And that their response may be, well, instead of 350 or 450 warheads, maybe we need 1,500 or 2,000.
According to James Lilly, the Chinese are especially worried that America might sell a missile defense system to Taiwan because, they say,
it gives Taiwan the shield it wants to move on an independent political course.
China is also worried that Washington might provide missile defense systems to Japan, a more active possibility than any such sale to Taiwan. Remembering Japanese aggression before and during World War II, the Chinese fear that theater missile defense would strengthen Japan vis-a-vis China. William Clark of the Japan Society.
This was something that certainly the Japanese were responsive to until the North Koreans fired the Taepdong across northern Honshu.
The Taepdong is a multi-stage missile being developed by North Korea.
And while you might be comfortable about China's restraint in use of missiles. They can't be that relaxed about the possible North Korean use of missiles. And so it has given added urgency to the theater missile defense.
The thousands of American troops stationed in Japan and South Korea also give urgency to theater missile defense systems. The United States, Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan all have an interest in such systems. If an effective missile defense is ever developed, it would protect these countries and leave them free to fire missiles back against a foe that had no defense. And that's why China is worried, and why it might well respond by building more and more missiles, hoping they would overwhelm any missile defense system. Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
Congress is getting a quick start this year on an issue it has been unable to resolve for the past two decades, modernizing the nation's banking laws. During the past 20 years, technological advances have brought banking, insurance, and securities activities closer together. But the laws that govern banking, written after the bank failures of the Great Depression, have not kept pace. NPR's John Itzty reports.
In an effort to forge banking laws appropriate for a new millennium, the House Banking Committee has begun a series of hearings. Today, lawmakers heard from a top banking regulator, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan. He voiced support for a bill offered by House Banking Committee Chairman Jim Leach of Iowa, which would allow the nation's banks, insurance companies, and securities firms to get into each other's business. Greenspan said modernizing the law has become an urgent matter.
Unless soon repealed, the archaic statutory barriers to efficiency could undermine the global dominance of American finance, as well as the continued competitiveness of our financial institutions and their ability to innovate and to provide the best and broadest possible services to U.S. consumers.
Greenspan added that it is important for Congress to set the rules of the nation's financial services industry, rather than having regulators try to adapt 80-year-old laws to today's realities. In fact, regulators have allowed a good deal of integration in financial services already. That's apparent to any consumer who walks into a bank nowadays to deposit money, buy mutual funds and insurance, all under one roof. The irony is that banking laws continue to bar many practices, but financial services companies have cleverly skirted the prohibitions with the acquiescence of regulators. Despite his desire for modern banking laws, Chairman Greenspan's differences with Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin over the structure of new financial services companies is one of the main obstacles standing in the way of reform. The differences between these two highly respected officials have contributed to congressional paralysis. The dispute was on Republican Sue Kelly's mind today as she questioned the Fed chairman.
What do you see are the obstacles to overcome to coming to some agreement between the two of you?
Let me put it this way. He and I work very closely together on virtually everything, so that the fact that we have been unable to come out with the same agreement in this area is not one from lack of trying or from a lack of collegiality. We have both.
But Greenspan said they have deep-seated differences. Rubin supports a plan put forward by Democrat John LaFalce of New York. It would preserve the administration's role in bank regulation. The problem, says Greenspan, is that under the Treasury's plan, banks would have closely integrated insurance and securities subsidiaries, which they would tend to subsidize even if they perform poorly. Greenspan thinks that structure has been proven inefficient in so-called universal banks in Europe and Japan.
Historically, it's turned out that the rates of return and the efficiencies that we see in the so-called universal banks have not been good. They clearly have not been up to the American model. That is, we have clearly outcompeted them. And I think a goodly part of it is the structure issue.
Greenspan prefers a structure of bank holding companies with affiliates in activities like insurance and securities. They would not be closely integrated into a bank legally, so if they underperformed or lost money, they could quickly be sold or shut down. An agreement on banking reform faces another obstacle on the other side of Capitol Hill. Senator Phil Graham, who took over the chairmanship of the Senate Banking Committee after Alphonse D'Amato was defeated in the general election, blocked the legislation at the end of the last session after it had passed the House. He objected to provisions crucial to Democratic support, which require greater investment in poor communities by financial institutions. John Itzke, NPR News, Washington.
Trying to detect heart disease early, that's next on NPR's All Things Considered.
And trying to get home efficiently, I'm Jennifer Jordan. This is WGBH. I've got a traffic report for you. The lower deck moves well. The central artery is also has eased out. The northbound side is still tough end-to-end. Sumner has some traffic inside it. The Ted Williams Tunnel is open to everyone until Tuesday at 5 a.m. because of the holiday. Storrow is back to the Longfellow westbound. You're slow from the Hatchell to Kenmore Square. The expressway is slowed down to Savin with a right lane breakdown before Columbia Road. Northbound, you're stalling out before the lane split. 93 is in good shape heading north, 128 below the speed limit from Wynn Street to 93. Southbound, an accident in front of the Burlington Mall is slowing you up. Route 3 north is slow at Treble Cove and from 495 to 110. 128 south of town is slow before University Ave. Route 3 is slow down to Union Street, and the Pike westbound has some solar glare delays from the TV towers out to the Star Market overpass. We're at 39 degrees in Boston. Actually, it's down to 36 now, and it's 520.
This is NPR's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. There's a new way of looking at the heart. It uses a specially designed CT or CAT scanner that can take a clear picture of the heart between beats when there's little motion. As NPR's Joanne Silberner reports, about 60 ultra-fast CT machines are already in use in the U.S., but cardiologists are still trying to figure out who should be scanned.
It used to be that x-rays could only tell you whether a heart was enlarged. CAT scans, also known as CT, use computer analysis to improve the x-ray image. But until recently, even CT machines couldn't take a decent picture of a moving object, a beating heart.
Yes. Hi, how are you today? I'm Sandy. I'm going to be doing your scan.
Okay. A 56-year-old accountant, Paul Kositska, has come to a quiet medical office in the basement of a Washington, D.C. office building for a new kind of CT procedure, an ultra-fast CT.
Great. I'm going to slide you right through the opening here.
It's one of the easiest medical tests for a patient, easier than giving a blood sample. The patient doesn't even have to take off his clothes.
The reason I use the EKG monitor is because it triggers the scanner so that it takes each scan at the least motion of each heartbeat. So it helps eliminate motion from your heart on the images. From this point on, the whole thing is less than 5 minutes.
This new kind of CT takes a picture of Kositska's heart between beats and can detect tiny bits of calcium.
Okay, you doing all right?
Yep.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and step out and we'll get started.
Calcium lodges in clogged arteries, the kind of clogs that can grow and eventually shut down the artery and cause a heart attack.
Mr. Kositska, can you hear me all right? Good, okay. Go ahead and take in a breath. Let that breath out.
Kositska hasn't had any heart problems in the past. He doesn't have any symptoms now, but he went to his doctor recently about a wrist injury.
And while we were discussing it, I mentioned that I had put on some weight and my exercise program had fallen off. And he mentioned that a year ago he had suggested that I do this because of the incidence of high cholesterol. So I thought, why not?
Kositska has a cholesterol level in the low 200s, and he and his doctor are trying to decide if he should do anything about it. Should he radically change his diet or go on drugs to lower his cholesterol? But drugs have potential side effects, such as liver damage, and cost several $100s a year. Or maybe his arteries are okay. Maybe there's no significant cholesterol buildup. Kositska would know for sure with an angiogram. That's where a catheter is snaked into the heart. It's an involved procedure with some risk. With an ultra-fast CT, there's really no danger. X-ray exposure is minimal, and the procedure is painless. A negative scan would be a big relief to Kositska.
Means I'll go out and have a cheeseburger. I guess it'll mean that there is no obvious signs of cardiovascular disease progression. So I'll feel happy.
There are no long-term studies of the accuracy of this test in predicting heart disease. Short-term studies show it's accurate to a point. Critics say it hasn't been proven to be any better than simply considering family history, cholesterol level, blood pressure, and other risk factors. Others say it's a direct measure of whether arteries are healthy or not. Insurers aren't of a single mind about ultrafast CT. Some pay when doctors order it. Cardiologist Stuart Seides of Washington, D.C. says he thinks seeing a positive scan can be helpful in getting a patient to eat healthy, get exercise, stop smoking, and bring blood pressure under control.
It is sometimes easier to motivate a patient when you say, we're treating you to prevent the progression of a disease that we know you have. This is not a theoretical. This is, we know you've got this disease. It is not obstructive yet, but you've got it, and you're going to get sick from it as you get older, so let's jump all over this thing.
Seides uses ultrafast CT in some men over 40 and women over 60 who have no overt symptoms of heart disease but are candidates for further investigation because they have a risk factor or two, such as a high cholesterol level. But some doctors worry that a negative test can give false reassurance to the point where a patient or doctor might ignore the early signs of a heart attack. They worry that a positive test can send people on to more invasive studies that may not be needed. One thing that makes doctors almost universally uncomfortable, the manufacturer has been marketing the procedure directly to the public. And at the five facilities it operates, it allows people to walk in off the street and have the $475 test without having seen a doctor first. Del Grant, CEO of the company that markets the ultrafast CT, says there are good reasons for going directly to the public.
The interest in advertising to the public is both public awareness, as well as, without question, there's a commercial angle to this as well. One of these facilities costs about $1,200,000 to $1,800,000 a year to operate.
No one is making a lot of money on it, he says, but the operating costs have to be recouped, and patients don't know how to ask their doctors about the scanner. Grant says he'd be delighted not to have to advertise to the public.
This is simply a way of getting this message out that there is a test out there that can identify people who have preclinical or subclinical coronary artery disease.
And not enough people know in time. As the company points out on its website, 48% of men and 63% of women who have heart attacks have no warning signs. But cardiologist Alan Taylor of the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research says physicians should make the decision. Physicians can pick patients who really need the scan and can make sure the patients understand that the test is not 100% predictive and can make sure patients interpret results correctly so they know a negative scan doesn't mean a clean bill of health.
Let's not be too naive about how people approach their lives. You know, if they can get away with eating an extra bowl of ice cream a night, most people would do it. I would do it. How the patient uses the result might be completely different than how we intend them to use the result.
Which is to say, if it's negative, that they still have to be careful, but they're not in trouble yet. Taylor is doing a long-term study of what happens after people get a positive or negative scan to see if the test makes any difference in people's long-term health. Until those results are known, he says, everyone should just act like they have a positive scan. Professional organizations are currently reviewing the value of the test. Meanwhile, Paul Kozitska got some good news. His arteries have no calcium, and his heart appears to be healthy. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
Tapes and transcripts of All Things Considered are available. Call anytime, toll-free. 1-877-NPR-TEXT. All Things Considered is a production of National Public Radio, which is solely responsible for its content. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from Vermont Teddy Bear, overnight bear gram delivery for a variety of occasions. Over 100 bears handmade in Vermont. 1-800-829-BEAR or on the web at VermontTeddyBear.com. World Wildlife Fund, working in more than 100 countries around the world to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. And Alltel at Alltel.com, bringing information technology solutions to financial and telecommunications clients in 48 countries. Alltel, always more than you thought. This is NPR National Public Radio.
I'm Bob Edwards. Tomorrow on NPR's Morning Edition, confusing messages on wine bottles. Winemakers have won the right to put labels on their products that tout the benefits of drinking. But there's concern about the wording of the labels and the scientific evidence behind the claims. Also, Valentine's poems from a famous lyricist. Tomorrow on NPR's Morning Edition.
Leave your radio tuned to 89.7 tonight so that you can start your day tomorrow with Morning Edition from 6 to 8 right here on WGBH. I'm Jennifer Jordan. Good evening. All Things Considered is made possible by Dover Rug Company, rugs and carpeting in classic, contemporary, and eclectic designs, located 1/2 mile west of Route 128 on Route 9 in Wellesley. And with the MathWorks of Natick, Mass., developers of MATLAB, the language of technical computing, used by educators, engineers, and scientists worldwide, the MathWorks family is proud to support public radio. After All Things Considered, Marketplace brings you the day's business news and its numbers at 6:30 tonight. Alan Greenspan's good news caused a surge on Wall Street, with both the Dow and the NASDAQ recovering some lost ground. Brazil's carnival is threatened as the country's economic woes continue to mount. Noodle experts are gathering at the Second World Ramen Summit. I kid you not. And phone calls, faxes, email, and snail mail from listeners. Coming up at 6:30. It's 5:30.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. American Airlines is going to court again because it says a pilot's sick out is continuing. A court hearing is scheduled tomorrow morning. Flights at American have been canceled again today, despite a federal judge's order yesterday for pilots to end their sick out. More than 1,000 American flights have been canceled, or nearly half the airline's schedule. Suzanne Sprague of member station KERA reports from Dallas.
Some of today's canceled flights are caused by pilots who continue to call in sick. Others stem from the difficulty of rescheduling flight crews and matching them with the appropriate plane in the appropriate city. The Allied Pilots Association, the union representing American pilots, has been encouraging its members to return to their scheduled flights. But due to a pilot shortage at the airline, approximately 1 in 5 flights depends on crews working voluntary overtime. Negotiations between American and the APA were scheduled to resume this afternoon. At issue is the pay scale for 300 Reno Air pilots who are being integrated into American's seniority scale. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Sprague in Dallas.
While the Senate continues to consider 2 articles of impeachment against President Clinton, it appears now a vote will come tomorrow. If there is acquittal on the 2 charges, it's unclear if a Democratic effort to get a vote on censure will be made. One senator, Democrat Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, said if Republican leaders prevent a censure vote, then supporters might draft a declaration and circulate it for senators to sign. In Germany, workers in the nation's auto and engineering industry have indicated their willingness for all-out strikes. This is trade union officials said that salary talks have collapsed. NPR's Edward Lifson reports from Berlin.
As preparations continued for an all-out strike by IG Metall, the world's largest industrial union, fears grew that industrial action could ruin Chancellor Gerhard Schröder's aim of getting employers and trade unions to work together to create jobs and lower Germany's 11.5% unemployment. This week, an employers group said it would abandon Schröder's Alliance for Jobs talks if the metal, auto, and engineering workers go ahead with a full-blown strike. IG Metall, with its 2.7 million members, is often involved in tough wage bargaining, including brinkmanship. Usually the bargaining is resolved before full-scale strikes are called. IG Metall is demanding a 6.5% raise. Employers are offering about 2.5%. The union plans to poll its members in several states this weekend to see if they support an all-out strike, which could begin as early as March 1st. This is Edward Lifson, NPR News, Berlin.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials added 186 points to end at 9,363. NASDAQ gained 96 points for the biggest one-day gain ever. The S&P 500 added 30. This is NPR News. Foreign ministers from Britain and France are taking part in Kosovo peace talks. Western diplomats are calling on Serb and ethnic Albanian officials to quicken their pace at peace efforts or face NATO airstrikes. More than 2,000 people have died and thousands have been left homeless in violence in the province. In order to get the warring parties to attend the talks in France, NATO threatened airstrikes and tougher measures to cut off weapons to rebel forces. Now both sides have been given 2 weeks to reach agreement. Despite predictions of an economic slowdown, the nation's economy continues to generate more jobs. Steve Beckner of Market News International has more on the story.
The Labor Department